thanks very much.
And we will likely stop you frequently.
Yeah, please. Yeah, please stop. So I'll tell you a bit about the kind of experiments we're setting up to make precision force sensors using these optically levitated objects. So this is a micron-sized or 10-micron-sized glass sphere here levitated in the center of an ultra-high vacuum chamber. So maybe I'll keep the theory intro very brief, since everybody in the audience is probably more of an expert than I am. But the basic idea is that if we have a very precise force sensor, we may be able to see new forces from some sort of beyond standard model physics. And the reason we may not have seen these forces before, of course, is that maybe they appear at weaker couplings or shorter distance scales than we've had a force sensor and accelerometer that can see. So the sort of systems that we're thinking about to make these sorts of very precise accelerometers or force sensors, at even at short distance, are these optomechanical systems. So there's really been, I think, an explosion of technology where we can actually control masses with optical techniques. So we can shine a light on a mass and cool and control its motion and also read out its motion, often cases in the kind of quantum regime where you've cooled this object so that the center of mass motion has, you know, order unity or zero phonon modes. Or occupation numbers. So this is kind of a picture of all these different optomechanical technologies that have been developed over the past couple decades from this nice recent review. And you can see they really span a wide range in masses. So we heard yesterday about kind of single trapped ions and atoms at the zeptogram scale, up through the nanogram scale, nanostructured materials, nano size scale and femtogram scale, microns, and then there's suspended membranes that have been very successful putting this in a cavity. And then even at the gram or kilogram scale, as in LIGO, you can actually control the massive degrees of freedom of these systems using light. So they're really a flexible and huge variety of technologies for making sensors out of these techniques. The specific optomechanical system I'm focusing on here is optically levitated micron-sized or 10-micron-sized dielectric masses. So the idea is very simple. If you have a vertically oriented trapping laser, you can trap a dielectric sphere just above the focus of that laser using few milliwatts of power for a kind of micron-sized sphere, up to hundreds of milliwatts for 10-micron spheres or 20-micron spheres. And this is actually an extremely common tool in biophysics. So these are called optical tweezers. They've really revolutionized how we understand forces in biological systems. So you can tie a DNA molecule or a polymer to the surface of this glass sphere, and you can pull on it and watch these motor proteins walk along. And there you're really interested in kind of pico-Newton scale forces. These are the force scales relevant for biological systems. And you're limited to those forces because you're sitting in some sort of fluid in biology, and there's thermal noise, just Brownian motion of your test mass due to the collisions with the particles in that fluid. However, if we wanted to get rid of that Brownian noise and get a better force sensor, we can just get rid of that fluid, so we can operate the same system in high vacuum. And in fact, at pressures that you can reach in the lab, so at the kind of good vacuum pressures we heard about in the ion traps yesterday, 10 to the minus 10 millibar, you can actually make the Brownian motion from the background gas collisions completely negligible, so that you're limited basically just by the shot noise of the laser. And if you turn your laser up high enough that you're actually limited by the back action of that laser or the motion of your test mass due to that readout light field, then you're at the so-called standard quantum limit. So LIGO now is essentially there for kilogram scale masses. There's really no reason that you shouldn't be able to get there with these smaller masses actually substantially more easily. So if you do get to that standard quantum limit, the sort of force sensitivity you might have is really exceptional. I mean, compared to these pico-Newton scales, force sensitivity for this micron scale object is 10 to the minus 21 newtons in a second measurement at these pressures. And that corresponds to an acceleration sensitivity of something like nano g's per root hertz. And the other nice thing about these systems is, like the ion traps, once you trap this object, it sits in there essentially forever. We've trapped these for 2 months or so before we've gotten tired and turned off the laser. So you can get very long integration times as well. So in principle, these numbers for force sensitivity can be extremely low. The other really nice thing about this system for actually trying to do a real measurement with it is not just the force sensitivity, but the ability to, which comes from being thermally isolated from the environment, but also the ability to electrically isolate these things. So when we're looking for some sort of new force from BSM physics, if there's any stray charge or background forces from electromagnetic sorts of forces, they can easily overwhelm the sorts of new physics we're looking for. So you want to be able to control the charge state and currents flowing to this test mass extremely well.
So why is the electric field isolated?
So it's sitting in the center of a vacuum chamber, only talking to the room temperature environment through a laser, so there's no mechanical support. You know, the other kind of, if you think about an atomic force microscope or a precision kind of silicon spring, you always have some mechanical connection to the environment that may have very high resistivity, but not infinite resistivity.
But how do you know that you don't have some residual charges on the microscope?
Yeah, so we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say thermally, what's the typical temperature this steers at? It sounds like it might be hot.
So the center of mass temperature can be in the emotional temperature can be very low. The actual internal degrees of freedom are very hot, and I'll come back to that also. Okay, so
I lost track of what was nano and micro. So how many approximately molecules are in the sphere?
Yeah, so we have a lot to play with here. So if you have a 10 micron sphere, you have something like 10 to the 16 nucleon atoms. So, but you can vary that over many orders of magnitude. So you might compare this to kind of macroscopic accelerometers, and something like a torsion balance is better. Macroscopic accelerometers are always better, but the advantage of this system is this is very good acceleration sensitivity for a micron scale sort of object. So if you're looking for forces that don't, you know, that are in smaller scale than a macroscopic accelerometer, this is what you'd want to use.
Can I ask a question? I'm just curious about very mundane issues.
Uh-huh.
Do you manufacture these spheres yourself, or you buy them?
We buy them because they're used in biophysics so much, there's now commercial suppliers.
So how spherical for your experiments and your measurements?
Yeah.
How spherical do they have to be?
So it's an important question. You get effective dipole moments if there's asphericity. All this stuff we worry about, maybe I'll come to it in the talk, but if not, you can stop me later. Okay. So I'll start with kind of explaining the technology of how we levitate these things, and then for most of the talk I'll be talking about the kind of beyond the standard model things that we're thinking about doing with these. The first is to really test the neutrality matter. So as I said, we can control the charge state extremely well, so you can actually, once you have a neutral object sitting in the center of that vacuum chamber, you can ask how neutral is it. You can hopefully test the inverse square law for gravity at short distance, and possibly also test the inverse square law for electromagnetism, or for Coulomb's law at short distance, and I'll come back to the motivations for all these, but again, experts in the audience should also ask questions or correct me. So this is what the experiment looks like. It's relatively simple compared to some of the AMO-style experiments, but definitely fits on a tabletop. So we have a trapping and an imaging laser. There's some optics to orient those vertically, and then focus actually two additional imaging beams onto the trap location. So if you look at the kind of simplified schematic here, our 1064 nanometer beam with kind of 1 to 100 milliwatts of trapping power is vertically oriented and focused, and we trap the microsphere in that infrared beam, and then we have these two additional green lasers that just come from doubling that trapping laser, which we focus in the two perpendicular directions so that we can measure all 3 degrees of freedom of the sphere's motion in real time. So the trick to making this work, unlike in biology, is that these traps aren't intrinsically stable at low pressure, so we have to actually measure the position of the sphere in real time and run that through a feedback loop where we modulate the optical potential to basically stabilize the sphere and cool its motion. So I'll talk a little bit more about this on the next slide. But you can, as I said, you can get extremely long trapping times once this feedback loop is running, and we've trapped 1 or 2 months at the current base pressure of our system, which is 10 to the minus 7 millibar.
Just in the slide previous, why was the sphere glowing red?
If I had an older image, we used to have a 650 nanometer imaging laser. Now it's in this system, it's 532. So the first question is how you get the spheres in the trap. Again, it's a bit harder than the biological tweezers where the spheres float by and you just move your laser over and grab them. Here the spheres want to fall freely, obviously in air and vacuum, so we actually smear them onto the bottom of a quartz cantilever and shake it really hard and shake off many, many spheres, and some tiny fraction of them actually fall through the focus of the laser, this kind of few micron squared region, and then they become trapped. If you measure, though, with an atomic force microscope how hard it is to pull these glass spheres off a surface, it's really hard. They're really dust particles with a high surface to mass ratio, so you need accelerations of 10 to the 6 meters per second squared. We get that with a piezoelectric stack that we oscillate or vibrate at hundreds of kilohertz, and that just sprays a cloud of dust particles down at the trap, and maybe one or two of them get trapped. Then we have a cover slip, though, that can keep our lens clean, and we can pull this whole loading system back once we have a sphere trapped and have a clean lens with a single sphere trap. Here's actually, to address the sphericity question, here's an SEM image of some commercial spheres from the manufacturer. We've measured the ellipticity ourselves under the SEM, and it tends to be at the percent level or better, but for the very precise things we're doing, we definitely see issues from the asphericity of these spheres. It's quite good, I mean, but it's not perfect for sure.
Biologists don't really care, right?
They don't, yeah.
In this setup, how important is the background gas for trapping, for initially trapping?
Yeah, so for initially trapping, we usually trap at a millibar or so, okay, so that they fall slowly enough. And the other nice thing is at a millibar, you don't need the feedback system, so they'll trap and be stable, and then you can turn the feedback on. That also contributes to our soft vacuum. So as I said, to make this trap work, you need active feedback cooling, so you need to monitor the motion of the sphere in all three dimensions, and when you see it moving to the right, push a little harder back towards the center of the trap. And you need this below about a millibar where you don't have enough dissipation from the residual gas in the chamber to actually dissipate energy from heating of the center of mass motion by the laser. So there's mostly conservative forces coming from the laser that are pulling the kind of dielectric object to the intensity maximum, but there is a scattering force that's non-conservative and can do work on the microsphere. If we don't dissipate that energy actively, then the sphere eventually, its center of mass degrees, heat up and jump out of the trap. So we just measure the position of the microsphere and modulate the position of the trap as well as the amplitude to cool its motion. Here you can see at low pressure, when we turn down that feedback loop as low as possible, this is the power spectral density of the position in one of the directions perpendicular to the beam versus frequency. So when we turn this feedback as low as possible, you see a nice high Q resonance at the natural frequency of the trap, which is a few hundred hertz. And then when you turn this feedback on, you see that the center of mass motion is cooled to an effective temperature of tens of millikelvin in all 3 degrees of freedom. But of course, the internal degrees of freedom of the spheres actually remain quite hot. We haven't yet seen any coupling between those internal degrees of freedom and the center of mass motion, but it's something that people are still interested in.
So, Dave, you are actually applying force at the same time you say the freedom measure.
Yeah, so we're applying, so you could still look at the error signal of the feedback loop. It's okay to do that. But actually, the way we do our feedback loop is we're applying a kind of notch feedback up here at the resonant frequency and doing our measurement down below 100 hertz. So at the frequencies we're measuring, we're applying forces or looking for forces, we aren't actually applying any feedback in our current system.
What's the mode at 150 hertz?
This thing, yeah, good question. Don't know.
It's dark matter?
Yeah, possibly. We do see some kind of nasty spectral lines. There's vibrations and lots of nasty things around.
You continue cooling throughout the experiment?
Yeah, so all the time this feedback loop has to be running. If we turn this feedback loop off, it actually, in a second, the sphere will jump out of the trap.
Can you drop the sphere and capture it?
Yes, you certainly can. You know, people have done experiments like that, actually looking at statistical mechanics properties as you turn off the laser field.
What's the mechanism for it? So, okay, I mean, I can see there's no dissipation, but is there some, is it just background gas, like scattering off a hot surface? Or?
That could be one mechanism. The other mechanism is the scattering force from the light itself.
From the photons, just photons.
Well, so this is a kind of statistical mechanics question that's still not answered, but you can imagine a trajectory because there's an intensity gradient in the laser field. There's a trajectory where you do net work on the sphere. So if you move up along the sphere axis and then return along a loop that's not along the sphere axis, you've done work on the sphere's center of mass motion. So the question is then why the sphere wants to preferentially be kicked up along the sphere axis, and there's papers that measure this in biological optical tweezers that claim there's these circulating sorts of motions of the spheres in these traps. The other mechanism, like you say, could be the bottom is hotter than the top and there's some residual gas that heats it. Once you have it trapped though, the first thing you need to be able to do is neutralize it, because if you have any stray charge, it's gonna present, you know, huge backgrounds for the sorts of measurements we're talking about. But you can control the charge on these microspheres with single electron precision. So it's very simple. You just put them in an oscillating electric field, just like the Millikan oil drop experiment. And then you measure the response of the motion of the microsphere to that oscillating field. And we flash the microsphere with UV light. And the plot on the bottom here is showing the response to that electric field versus time. And you can see we can calibrate that into units of a net charge of a single electron, because very nicely correlated with these flashes of UV light, you see discrete steps of one or maybe two electrons. And then once the microsphere gets down to a net integer charge of zero, you can turn that off and it stays neutral for a very long time. We've measured actually charging rates depending if certain electron sources are on in the chamber of something like an electron per day. So this is a yoctoamp of current, which I think is the lowest SI unit for current. But we can actually turn that off if we, or reduce that charging if we put an electric field across here. The source of those electrons appears to be not on the gold electrodes right next to the trap. So if you have an electric field, it keeps those electrons from reaching the trapping region. And you know, we've seen less than a charge a week or less than a charge a month, actually. Okay, so once you have that kind of neutralized object in the center of your vacuum chamber, you might ask, how neutral is it, or could there be any deviation from neutrality? So one motivation for this that's maybe relevant here is to search for milli-charged dark matter particles bound in the microsphere. So the very simple experimentalist picture of this is we have some hidden sector with maybe a dark photon or some new gauge force, which is weakly coupled to the standard model. And then from some sort of kinetic mixing or something like this, the particles which have unity charges under this new dark force pick up milli-charges or tiny fractional charges under standard model electromagnetism with some weak coupling epsilon. So then you can look for a charge with some tiny fraction of an electron. And in some region of parameter space, these sorts of particles might be able to form bound states with atoms and get stuck in kind of neutral matter. Well, so we're kind of, this is maybe not the most up-to-date plot, so I'd be happy to talk to experts. I know, especially with the EDGES result, there's been lots of thinking about milli-charged particles. We're basically mass-independent, which is the nice thing about this. You know, very massive particles, if they can get stuck in the spheres, we can see them. And I'll show that, you know, in principle, we can get down to very low sorts of epsilons. We've already gotten down to kind of microcharges and nanocharges are possible for sure. And, you know, so below the electron mass, there's, of course, lots of very strong limits from astrophysical objects and then accelerators at higher masses. But, you know, in this region above the reach of accelerators, we could still be sensitive as long as the objects could get stuck. Yes. So if you see them, it's interesting. There's, I think, no real way to predict their abundance. So it's impossible to go backwards. Yeah, that's right.
When would you expect dark matter to be stuck, bound to your spheres?
When would we expect?
What do I need to get there? Is that what you just asked?
Maybe this goes back to the question. If you had some cosmological abundance of this, it's, I think, impossible to calculate what the enrichment fraction in a silica sphere is. But if you make the assumption that there's some amount of these things in normal matter, you can look for them in normal matter.
I mean, maybe the question is just how large does it have to be for them to be actually bound in normal in these spheres?
How large does the charge
have to be in order to actually have a stable binding?
Well, again, in
2 weeks, it's just going to
fall through.
Exactly. So in my very simple experimentalist, if you take the binding energy from the Bohr model, I mean, for very massive particles, you're able to access smaller and smaller milli charges, but for the lighter things, you aren't. So I'd be happy to talk to people about this sort of thing. My understanding is there has been some work on 1 plus epsilon charges and 2 plus epsilon charges, and presumably those could be bound. But it's not clear if they're as interesting.
Those will have much stronger constraints than...
Sorry?
Those will have much stronger constraints than... you mean just for normal matter?
Well, yeah, we'll come... Maybe I'll show the kind of...
So essentially for that, we're assuming that there is a sub-fraction of this particle which is directly coupled to the sphere, rather than you have these dark matter halo particles which are somehow actually stuck to it.
Yeah, these would be particles that got stuck in the spheres either in the early universe or from... They have some constant density from the background dark matter passing through things.
Right, but that's when you need to run the calculations for actual binding.
Yeah, so we're purely doing an experimental test of what is the neutrality of a chunk of matter, and then I know that it's a difficult theoretical question to put any sort of constraints on models, but that's what we're testing is. So, you know, people have looked for neutrality of macroscopic chunks of matter before, and there's, you know, two motivations. There's these sorts of fractional charges that we were just talking about, where people in the past have been most interested, partly due to the technology and kind of free quarks. So this is a recent experiment from Marty Pearl's group at SLAC, where in 2007, actually, they made this automated Millikan oil drop experiment where they had an inkjet printer, essentially, that printed 40 million oil drops. And they see this very nice Gaussian distribution in charge. No charge is obviously out here at plus or minus a third. But they designed the experiment to look for these free quarks, and they're not sensitive to kind of tiny fractional charges in matter. The other motivation for these tests is, does the electron and proton have exactly the same quantized charge? And there's kind of two state-of-the-art experiments. One is an acoustic resonator technique where you put SF6 or some gas in an acoustic resonator, apply an acoustic frequency electric field, and then have a microphone here to look for some collective motion of the gas due to a possible charge. This limits the sum of the proton and electron charge to something like 10 to the minus 21 electrons. Actually, the state of art for the neutron charge is still this old experiment from 1988. We just shoot a neutron through an electric field and look at its deflection. There's been a couple of attempts to do better than this, but nobody's actually improved on this older experiment. If you look in the PDG for the neutrality of matter, there's 100-year-old measurements in this field. We're now, many experiments have kind of hit this threshold of 10 to the minus 21 electrons. And over the past 45 years, actually, it hasn't really been improved, that state of the art. And not because people haven't necessarily been trying, but because it's a very difficult experiment.
Do you know what the binary pulsar is coming from?
Yeah, I can't say I do. There's various astrophysical limits on, fractionally charged particles and neutrality of matter. My understanding, though, is almost all astrophysical systems have sufficient currents flowing between the objects that it's difficult to come up with robust constraints.
I know this is an unfair picture, but is there any method? 10 to the negative 21 is so specific, and it hits like five different. Is there some scale that I'm missing that is 10 to the negative 21 times like my head or something?
There's lots of funny experimental results over time where people pile up at values. It could just be publication bias where when people get to the limit, they. I mean, it could be a social effect. I mean, it's a hard experiment, and actually, I think this result in 73 is wrong. The recent result that repeated it found it was completely wrong.
But I mean, not just those two, the two above it, on totally different physics also right there.
Yeah, no, that's right. It could be publication bias. I agree, it seems very strange. So the first thing we did once we got these spheres trapped a few years ago was to do this test. So you neutralize the microspheres so you know you have exactly the same number of electrons and protons. So you start at relatively low voltage, oscillating voltage applied to these plates. You knock the electrons off, and then you substantially increase the electric field. And if you zoom in on the inset here, the response now is in units of 10 to the minus 3 electrons. You integrate overnight and then look for any offset in that distribution from zero. And we repeated this for 10 microspheres that had a total mass of about a tenth of a nanogram. So we actually did see a statistically significant residual response, but when you measured the direction of that response in 3D, it's actually perpendicular to the electric field, so it was in the direction of the electric field gradient. So as you might expect, you have a net monopole charge of zero, but there can still be dipole moments in these 10 to the 14 charges, and they're going to produce an apparent or a real motion of the sphere in the direction of electric field gradient. So that wasn't evidence for, milli-charged particles or non-neutrality of matter, but we can still conservatively set some sort of parameter space limits. And you see this doesn't appear on the milli-charged plot I showed before, but it's showing four searches in matter, what are the limits on the abundance of such particles bound in matter versus their fractional charge. The previous searches that we're looking for free quarks are down here, and then the conservative limits, assuming those dipole responses are due to a milli-charged particle, are shown by the gray box here. Well, it means if you have some nucleons in your sphere and some fraction of them have a milli-charged particle bound to them, this is the fraction. Sorry?
In the mass, you'd have to have 100 nucleons.
Yes.
A single one.
It's their concentration per nucleon in matter.
Right. So for this experiment, the resonant frequency is something like 200 hertz,
yeah.
Like what you showed before.
Yeah.
Are you guys, two questions, are you applying resonant AC drive, and do you get a factor of Q enhancement or something from that? And why not, what limited your voltage, I guess?
Yeah, so we are not applying a resonant drive because we're limited by real pointing noise of the laser and not by the kind of additive noise of our imaging system, so it doesn't help to apply on resonance because your noise is enhanced by the same factor of as your signal. So we actually do this measurement with a frequency comb over the full bandwidth of the resonator and fit the transfer function. But you don't have to do that. You get the same answer if you just did it at a single tone. And then
voltage.
Yeah, so we could go higher, but since we're limited by a dipole moment background, it doesn't matter. But I'll talk more about this. So this was kind of a very first thing you do with an unoptimized setup once you have it discharged. Sorry, go ahead.
In terms of the net charge on the sphere, what is the bound?
The net charge, so for the best sphere here, it was like 5, 10 to the minus 5 electrons. Okay, so this was the very first thing we did, but it was done with completely unoptimized setup, so you might ask what you could do if you could do better. The first thing you might want to do for the neutrality of matter, so the proton and electron charge, would be to use larger spheres. We find that our acceleration sensitivity actually improves with the larger masses, and something like a proton and electron charge difference would keep adding up, so you really care about acceleration sensitivity. So the first question is, how large of a sphere can you optically trap? So in the first experiment, we're using these tenth of a nanogram spheres, and we've trapped now 100 times more massive spheres, so these have a diameter of about 10 microns. And we found that, like I said, this plot on the bottom left is showing the acceleration sensitivity in units of micro little g, so little g is Earth's gravitational acceleration, per root hertz, and you see it improving by more than an order of magnitude for these larger spheres. And if we integrate for 10 to the 4 seconds, we get a sensitivity at the nano G level with these largest spheres. So this is a few orders of magnitude more sensitive than any other accelerometer at this length scale. So the thing we notice, though, is that when we get much bigger than 10 nanograms, we actually see these spheres vaporize in our trap, or at least substantially reduce in size when we go from our trapping pressure to low pressure. So here you can see two different spheres that were 30 nanograms when we started, and if we look at the same sphere when we've pumped down to low pressure, they're substantially smaller. So what we think is happening is that actually the way they make these spheres is they grow them through this Stober process, a Sol-gel process, where they accrete the silica in fluid, and they get a lot of water and selenol and other nasty things inside the spheres. And this, our 1064 near-infrared light is actually absorbed by those water impurities and heating these up to 1300 Kelvin or so, where they can vaporize at these pressures. So we think we really are seeing them vaporize due to the extremely high center internal temperature.
With this very accurate measurement of little g, have you thought of using your apparatus to do various geophysical exploration one can think of?
Right.
Looking for mineral deposits even.
So this is a very precise measurement of accelerations at microscopic distances. So if those sorts of applications wanted a microscopic measurement of the local value of little g, this would be interesting. Most of those things, though, I think are better served by macroscopic accelerometers.
More global.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned the gas limited you to nano g's per root hertz. So here we have micro g's. What is the limitation here?
It's pointing noise of the laser, so technical source, non-fundamental sources of noise.
The laser itself?
Yeah, this is actually that the laser mode is not perfectly TM00. And, you know, we have a very good laser. It's the same laser that LIGO uses in their first stage, but we don't have all the cleanup after it that they have. So we'll move, hopefully, towards getting rid of that technical noise. It's not fundamental, but we're about three orders of magnitude from it.
Vaporization effects, but much smaller for your smaller spheres, or just suddenly is there some sudden onset after which size you start getting this vaporization?
The polarization?
No, but you are saying that.
Oh, this vaporization.
So
the way our trap works is that the mass is balanced by the radiation pressure from the laser, so the power needed to trap these is going up. So this is showing the laser power versus mass, and there is an onset where at some point. The heating.
Sure, okay, so it is a threshold for that.
It's a threshold, yeah. Okay, so this limits us to, you know, some size unless we can grow better spheres without the water in them, but for now we're at least a factor of 100 bigger in size.
So when you measure the ellipticity, did you measure it therefore before you actually put the sphere in?
We cannot measure it yet for a single sphere. I mean, in principle, if you could think of ways to do it. At the end, what we really care about in this measurement is the dipole moment that would come from that ellipticity, and we have ways of precisely measuring the sum of all dipole moments. So that's what we've been focusing on. So that brings me to dipole backgrounds. So if you think about what the primary background you'd expect for a neutral microsphere is, it's of course due to dipoles and higher multiple moments. There's both a permanent dipole, some sort of baked in asymmetry in that charge distribution in the sphere, or some sort of ellipticity that makes the dipole moment in one direction different. And then of course there's also an induced dipole when you apply this electric field we're using to do our measurement. But the nice thing is that this induced dipole is going to oscillate at twice our drive frequency, whereas the permanent, so that allows us to kind of quantify forces on that induced dipole and then use that to constrain background forces at the frequency of interest that would come from this permanent dipole moment or ellipticity or something like this. So the way you get rid of any of these sorts of dipole moments or forces due to them is because they all couple to the gradient of the electric field instead of the value of the electric field, you try to make as uniform of an electric field as possible. And it turns out in our setup that means aligning the electrodes that are surrounding the trap to as good of an angular alignment as possible. So we do this pretty simply just by having a semi-transparent gold coating on one of our glass electrodes, and then we can shine a laser in situ, get some fraction reflected off that front surface of this electrode, and then a second reflection off that. And then even without doing interferometry or anything fancy, just doing something very simple where we line those spots up on the wall 10 meters away, that's good enough to get us to the kind of 100 microradian alignment that we need to sufficiently suppress this background for our current measurements. These are hard experiments, though, so it's always good to be able to constrain backgrounds in different ways. So you can also further cancel any residual background by just applying a DC field that you step the polarity of. When you do that, the dipole moment's going to flip direction, and you're going to cancel out the force on the dipole, but this AC field, the monopole, will still add up. So we just do the measurement switching back and forth a DC field, and you can see in this plot on the bottom right where we've purposely misaligned the plates, so introduced an electric field gradient. You can actually see that the positive and the negative cancel nicely, so that there's some cancels the effect of this electric field gradient where we have a 2 milliradian misalignment. You do see some structure here which we don't fully understand, which is some time variance.
This permanent dipole is presumably body fixed in the sphere. Like, this sphere is motionally cold and internally hot, and rotationally it is.
Next slide. Oh, sorry. Yeah, no problem. So you can completely get rid of the force on this dipole, we think, by making the field very uniform. But even with a perfectly uniform field, you can still have torques, of course. And in fact, when you apply this electric field, this if it's a fixed dipole, it's going to want to line up with the field. And if the sphere is at all non-spherical, then you can, even if the center of mass is not moving, you can infer there's motion of the center of mass from this rotation of the sphere due to that torque. So we've actually now been able to rotate these spheres. I'll come to this on the next couple of slides. But the basic idea is that if you were able to spin this sphere with essentially infinite angular momentum around the beam axis, then first you average out the permanent dipole moment that's perpendicular to that axis. But also if there's any torque, it's going to have a very small effect on the angular alignment of the sphere, because you'll get a little bit of precession, but that's a negligible effect as this angular momentum becomes very large. So one way you might think to spin the spheres is to grow birefringent spheres. So this has been shown in the biological traps where you can actually grow vaterite, which is a polymorph of calcite. So it's a fairly birefringent crystal, and you can grow these relatively circular spherical objects with it. And you can see here from some of the spheres we grew in our lab that when you set cross polarizers, you can make the background light go away, but you still see bright spots in the center of the sphere, so it's showing that they're rotating the polarization of the light passing through the spheres. So if you have such a birefringent sphere and you send circularly polarized light through it, it's going to rotate the polarization, so there must be a restoring torque on the sphere which causes it to spin up. So you can control an optical torque on the sphere. So in kind of liquid traps, they've demonstrated controlled rotation at hundreds of hertz. In high vacuum, of course, you have much lower damping, so you can go to much higher frequencies. And we can actually go up to several megahertz frequencies that are really limited by the material strength of the object that we're spinning so that it doesn't blow apart. So we added some control of the polarization so that we can modulate the polarization of the trapping light from left circular to right circular or to some intermediate polarization. And then we also have a polarization-sensitive readout. The plot on the bottom right here is showing a power spectral density of the signal recorded by that polarization-sensitive readout. And you can actually see very nicely two sets of peaks here as we change the voltage on this electro-optic modulator, which corresponds to changing the polarization of the light. And at this relatively high pressure of 10 to the minus 2 millibar, you come to some terminal rotational speed where the gaseous drag is balancing your optical torque. And you can change that by changing your optical torque and change the rotational frequency. So the biggest peak here where you see it at twice the rotational frequency is just because you're looking at the change in the polarization as this birefringent object rotates. So as it rotates 180 degrees, you see it come back to the same value. So you get twice the frequency due to that birefringence. But because the spheres are a little bit aspherical, you also just have some modulation of the light at the fundamental frequency as well. So you see a smaller set of peaks down here at f-rot. As we change the circularity of the light, you see very nicely that it exactly, the terminal speed exactly follows what you might expect, and you can calculate the angular accelerations or torques that you can apply. And for this birefringent material, they're extremely high, something like 10 to the 6 radians per second squared. We've also noticed, though, that you can even optically rotate amorphous silica objects, which you wouldn't necessarily expect to be birefringent. So this is either due to some trace birefringence of these amorphous materials or some sort of absorption of the light or some residual ellipticity. So you can't apply as large angular accelerations, something like 4 orders of magnitude smaller, but in high vacuum, that's actually not a problem because you can still spin, even with tiny amounts of torque, spin objects up to extremely high frequencies. So this is kind of shown here. So this is showing the rotational frequency that we measure for the spheres as a function of time for one of these Vatterite spheres. This is 10 to the minus 5 millibar here on the color scale. And you see this thing spin up with a damping time of something like 500 seconds. And then we actually lose it from the trap at just above 5 megahertz, where if you calculate the centrifugal stress, it's close to the yield strength of the material. So the spheres are spinning faster and faster until they basically blow apart, and it's just limited by how strong of a material you can get. As I said, we can also spin these amorphous silica spheres. Here you can see us reverse the direction of the optical torque halfway through, and you can control the sign of the optical torque. Here where we just let this spin up, you can see that the damping time you infer is something like close to a day for the sphere at 10 to the minus 7 millibar. And if you look at the damping times we measure versus pressure for these spheres, it's actually following a 1 of repeat dependence all the way down to our base pressure of our system. So in principle, you can get extremely low damping. So actually, compared to the center of mass degrees of freedom, we're completely limited by the pressure for these rotational degrees of freedom, we'd like to actually go to lower pressure and see how long this damping time can get. But this is already a very low dissipation mechanical system, so at this base pressure, this sphere is going to rotate 10 to the 11 times in a single damping time. So it might be interesting to talk to people here. We've been thinking about this in terms of backgrounds, but if there could be some sort of torques from some fluctuating torques or something from a background dark matter field, this might be a very low dissipation system to look for that in, and it's not even clear how low dissipation it can be.
What is the speed of the surface?
Of the surface, 5 megahertz times 10 microns, so I don't have that number directly on my head right now, but this, we did calculate the stress.
Silicon oxide just basically sand?
Yeah, so it's something like very bad glass, where you have water and other impurities in the glass.
I see,
yeah.
So when they manufacture these things, they don't care about
the purity? They don't. I mean, the process that gives you very round things gives you lots of impurities. There's another process that's like making shot where you just throw, you know, glass dust and heat it in a flame. That doesn't give you the water impurities, but you get more elliptical objects.
You say these things actually fall apart when you spin them?
Yeah, that's our understanding of why we lose them. The stresses that you calculate are very comparable to the yield strength.
Are you assuming, you say spheres, but are they spherical tops or symmetric tops, or probably in reality asymmetric tops because, you know, everything's in reality asymmetrically?
Yes.
I mean, I think a lot about molecules doing this, where I can quantify that as something called single quantity, and a spinning object that's an asymmetric top is like, it melts your brain when you look at it.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
So is there any dynamics here from a slightly asymmetric top spinning for a whole day?
There,
maybe 10 to 11 times.
I'm sure those effects are important. I will say that the ellipticity is at the percent level, and if you look at the residuals from this thing, you don't see any like indication of lots of precession or anything. These things follow the spin up, we expect sub-percent residuals.
Can you use the fabulous the rotating to apply the extra, you know, extra force to sort of make a version of torsion balance?
Right, so you can make a torsional oscillator. It's going to be the same dissipation we're measuring here is extremely low for a torsional oscillator. So if we add the Vatterite sphere and we apply linear polarization, it's going to rotate around that.
But can you make experiments?
Yeah, I'd love to talk to people about that. Yep. Okay, so let me go on. So if we are able to get rid of the backgrounds, you know, get to the kind of what we think is a reasonable target for backgrounds in this sort of neutrality of matter experiment. This is naively drawing the sensitivity that you'd have to these non-neutrality of matter. So the plot on the left is kind of a funny axis because it's the signed proton plus electron charge on a log scale. So there's an axis break here where the sign switches versus the neutron charge. If you're willing to assume charge conservation and beta decay, maybe these are measurements of the same thing, but here being fully general, you can draw this 2D parameter space where you see the best neutron limit as a vertical line and then the best kind of matter limits or sum of proton and electron as these kind of boxy regions. And this is maybe the projected sensitivity that this setup would have in the near term where maybe we can finally go something like an order of magnitude beyond this 10 to the 21 limit that lots of people have gotten stuck at. And this is fully dependent on what backgrounds we see. If you look at the intrinsic sensitivity of these things, they can go many orders of magnitude lower. But really the question is how low can the dipole backgrounds be?
Why is the plot so symmetric?
Asymmetric?
Yes.
So why is there this? Well, so in this funny thing where you're not assuming charge conservation, the sign of this can be exactly opposite the neutron charge sign, and then there's this kind of line where they're equal, where you can't set any constraints. If you translated that into the same parameter space, you know, this kind of faux parameter space for millicharged particles that I showed previously, this is the unoptimized search here in blue, and this is what you might be able to do with a variety of sphere sizes. For the neutrality of matter, you want to use the biggest sphere possible, but you can see there's some trade-off between abundance and fractional charge for the early charged particles.
What does the dotted lines indicate?
Yeah, so these are, if you're willing to assume some abundance or, you know, some abundance of the two different signs, so if you had both signs of millicharged particles bound in matter, if they all had the same sign, they would give you this line, and if they had opposite signs, they'd give you this line. I should say that all of these searches, maybe with the exception of the Well, even the recent Pearl search, they all see offsets from zero in the charge they measure. So if that were many millicharged particles bound in the spheres adding up, then they would kind of be along this line. And we'd be able to see single particles of those charges in this setup. That makes sense? Okay, so let me kind of go on because there's a few other topics. So the next kind of obvious thing you might do with this system is try to test the inverse square law of gravity down to short distances. Maybe I'll go quickly on the theory motivation. If you add a new scalar to the standard model, you can get these sorts of forces between masses, and there can be more complicated spin-dependent forces, as you all know, and everything like this. Maybe the thing I'll highlight is that one set of new scalars that people have been thinking about are if you want to explain dark energy as a new scalar field, you might add a new scalar to the standard model. You need some sort of complicated screening mechanism, so a lot of these models are quite complicated, but maybe the thing I'll point out is that just from dimensional analysis, if you take the energy density we observe in dark energy and convert that to a length scale, you get 80 microns. So generically, it might be interesting to test gravity as well as we can below this length scale of 80 microns.
Explain how extra dimensions will then cause the
non-Newtonian
forces?
Well, so, you know, these large extra dimensional models are trying to address the hierarchy problem by saying that gravity is propagating in some higher dimensional bulk. So gravity actually has the same strength as the other forces, it's just it's in a higher dimensional space than the standard model forces, which are in some subspace. And then there's just this Gauss's law argument in high dimensions where gravity appears to be weaker in our lower dimensional subspace. you know, these have been tested by Etwash for a single extra dimension. If you add two extra dimensions, you get down to roughly the micron scale.
So they are not really, is this a different effect from the compositification which wouldn't produce the same?
Yeah, this is a different effect. I mean, there, you know, I guess I'd summarize this slide from the experimentalist point of view is people have written lots of ways to modify gravity at short distance. I'll show you what we know about gravity at short distance, but it might be especially interesting if we can to push down well below 100 microns, which we haven't been able to do yet. This is what we know about gravity. So usually just for making the plot, we parameterize it with this Yukawa form. So you have some length scale lambda and some coupling alpha. So this is showing the strength parameter alpha versus this length scale over many, many orders of magnitude. And at the astrophysical distances where you have distances where lunar laser ranging is sensitive, for instance, any sort of deviation has to be a tiny perturbation. So the dotted line here is 1/r² gravity. But as you go to shorter and shorter distances and it's becoming harder to concentrate enough mass to see these sorts of gravity-like effects, or gravitational effects, then these constraints are cutting off very sharply, especially at distances well below 100 microns. So if you zoom in on this very short distance regime where these systems are interesting, you can see the Edwash experiments here, which have measured order unit gravity in this this setup down to about 60 microns. But by the time you get down to a micron, you're already at something like 10 to the 7 times the strength of Newtonian gravity. So there could be scaling in these units, normalizing to the strength of gravity, there could be very large forces, and there's some selection of theories here in these dotted lines from a somewhat older paper showing that you can write down theoretical models where you have new forces that are much larger than gravity, but you'd also like to test this 1/r² gravity line as low as you can in length scale as well.
What was that experiment in 2016?
So this is essentially a Casimir force experiment. It's a gold sphere on an AFM tip that they get close to a surface. I will say that I encourage people to read the paper. There's some strange things about how they get that sensitivity. Okay, so the trick here is that it's easy to make an oscillating electric field for the measurements we were doing for neutrality, but for a gravity-like experiment, you'd ideally like to have an oscillating gravitational potential that's modulating at some reasonable frequency of tens or 100 hertz and with a structure of kind of micron scale distance. So at Yale, what we're looking into, and this gravity work is in collaboration with Stanford, where we're working on different ways for making this modulating gravitational field. At Yale, what we're looking at is these commercial microdroplet systems. So again, borrowing technology from biologists, where you can make very uniform droplets of some dense fluid in a carrier fluid. And then the idea is to take something like a liquid metal, like a gallium indium eutectic alloy, which has a high density, and flow it in an oil carrier solution in a gold-coated capillary next to the sphere, and then look for the sphere to have a periodic motion where it's attracted to these dense droplets in the capillary. And we've been able, in a 100-micron capillary, to make some oil and water uniform, I wouldn't say spherical droplets, but kind of cylindrical droplets, and we're working to kind of get this whole system together. The nice thing about this is this gold-coated capillary can be very thin-walled, so we have capillaries with a 5-micron wall thickness and 100-micron diameter, and in principle, up to effects of the capillary wall pulsing as these droplets go behind it, it's a perfectly stationary shield that can be coated with a good conductor to minimize any sort of electrical effects from these mass patterns flowing behind it.
Can you characterize the geometry here?
So
this is trapped and this is passing horizontally?
Yeah, maybe it's easiest to see in this cross-sectional view. So the laser's propagating up, the microsphere is trapped at the focus, and then you have the capillary positioned at micron distances from the side, and these droplets are flowing into or out of the page here in the cross-section.
Okay, this.
Yeah. And you can flow these at tens or 100 hertz very quickly through the capillaries. The reason we need to do this, of course, there's lots of pretty fundamental electromagnetic backgrounds, or at least practical electromagnetic backgrounds that make the gravity measurement very hard. Even if we had a perfectly neutral microsphere with no dipole moment sitting next to that capillary, you would still have a Casimir force between the mass variations in the fluid and the microsphere itself. So we can calculate what the difference in the Casimir force between the metal droplets, the dense metal droplets, and the oil would be. This is for a slightly different setup where we have gold and silicon as the density variations, but basically the silicon doesn't matter here, and what you care about is the electrical conductivity difference between the two materials, so it's quite similar for the liquid metal and oil. And you can calculate, you know, if you coat this with gold, then you see the same equipotential surface in principle everywhere, and you're not sensitive to the droplets flowing behind it. Of course, any real conductor has finite conductivity, especially at the high frequencies that are relevant for the Casimir effect, so you need some finite thickness of that gold shield to be able to have to fully screen that differential Casimir force. So this is the difference in the Casimir force that's felt when the metal droplet goes by the sphere versus when the oil droplet goes by. And you can see if you calculate what the thickness needs to be for this gold shield, then with relatively modest thicknesses at the micron scale or few micron scale, you can actually sufficiently, we think, suppress this Casimir force. Another
shield, the thickness of the capillary itself is Rinning's change in the observed conductivity on the other side, and that's reducing the
Well, the mass-dependent force is not screened by that. Electrical forces are. But you are getting farther away because you now have to have a shield. So we're trying to think, how can you make the lowest profile shield that fully contains the mass that you can get close to? And a 5-micron wall with a micron of gold on it is pretty good for these sorts of distances. The other thing you worry about is that there's some sort of, you know, I said this gold surface is an equipotential, but of course a real conductor is not an equipotential when you zoom in on it. And if you measure, for instance, the topography and the electric potential on the surface of a gold film, you see these electric potential variations, typically of tens of millivolts, that actually are correlated with the grains in the polycrystalline gold film that you've deposited. So even if you had a perfectly clean gold film, it would have some potential at its surface when you get very close to it. Of course, the reason you want this capillary is that that's completely stationary and the droplets flowing behind it are at some higher frequency. So in principle, this background doesn't couple, but if there's some secondary motion of the capillary as the droplets are flowing, you have to worry about higher order effects from these sorts of patch potentials. So this is something we can measure, though. If you charge up the sphere, it's actually a good way to measure patch potentials. This is something surface scientists are interested in.
What's the length scale for the variation?
Well, it tends to be the grain size, so at least for very clean films, you actually can vary it by the grain size. This is a 50 nanometer grain film, which you can kind of see from the bumps. So, you know, naively, if we're able to make a sort of attractor that makes this background free, so we're not seeing these patch potentials or Casimir force or some other background we haven't thought of, this is what the sensitivity you could get to with these systems looks like. So again, this is that short distance regime where we're plotting length scale from 1 to 100 microns versus strength of the new force. For our kind of larger 10 micron scale spheres, what we think we could do in the near future is this kind of blue line, again, conditional upon being able to keep the backgrounds below our sensitivity, and then at the standard quantum limit, you can get down to the kind of blue dashed line here. If you optimize it for a different size sphere, and I should also highlight that Andy Gerasi at Northwestern is also thinking about these smaller spheres, you may not probe as far down in strength, but you can go to shorter distance scales potentially. So again, this is just schematically to show you where you might be able to get, but really our reach will depend a lot on what the backgrounds we see are as we try to do this.
What is the what is the frequency of the droplets passing by the sphere, and how hard is that to do? Is this like a trivial thing to do and control?
I wouldn't say it's trivial, but to date we've only had an undergraduate working on it, and she's used a commercial system to make these droplets. I think we're going to have a grad student start working on it, and I think it's not hard because you can commercially buy pumps and capillaries and all this stuff that makes it happen. You just have to put it together.
Okay, and the size variation of the droplets shouldn't matter much. And what is the frequency at which they pass?
Tens to 100 hertz. So even at 100 hertz, the flow rates are nanoliters. So it's completely controllable, and we'll also measure the drops coming in and the drops coming out. So, and maybe we like to use frequency combs instead of single frequencies, so we can do all that.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? Yep. Like, Do you know the frequency, the 100 hertz or 104 hertz? Do you know the phase? Do you know when the oil is going past the...
Yeah, so we will need to know that. So not pictured here is a little hole in the gold on both sides where we have a laser shining at it and we're measuring the flow. Yeah, so that system's all being designed, and you know, hopefully this year we'll have this installed in our chamber. Okay, so this is where we're going in terms of short distance gravity. Let me just quickly tell you what we've done already. So we haven't yet made these kind of fancy attractors, but we've made the kind of dumbest gravitational attractor you can think of, which is a silicon cantilever that's been coated in gold, which we can then oscillate next to the trap and see if there's any apparent motion of the sphere as we oscillate that test mass nearby. Of course, the challenge with this is all those electrostatic backgrounds I talked about fully couple to the sphere in this geometry. So it's not the best thing we can do, but actually already you can test some of these kind of very exotic models for screen scalar dark energy. And again, the motivation here is to try to do the tests of these models at short distance. So we can get this test mass within tens of microns of our sphere and see if there's any obvious forces on it. Oh yeah, it's on a very fancy stage, so you can buy these nano positioning stages that have nanometer resolution, so much better than you need, and we drive it with a harmonic voltage. That said, though, you can also record it and do whatever you want.
What's the amplitude of the oscillation?
Yeah, maybe I'll show that on the next couple slides. So before I get to the actual measurement, as I said, backgrounds are very bad in this setup because these same dipole moments are going to couple to any sort of electric potential on the cantilever. So here you can see just a simulation of what the gradient, electric field gradient near the tip of that cantilever looks like. It's a sharp tip, so you have bad gradients. And we oscillate the tip with a distance of 20 to 250 microns from the tip of that cantilever. You can actually separate the permanent induced dipole moment when you do this because the induced dipole moment obviously is going like e squared. The permanent dipole just has a single factor of e, so you can separate out the spatial dependence as you oscillate this if we purposefully misbias this. So that's what's shown here. We've applied a voltage to the gold coating on that cantilever. We've oscillated it from here 20 to 250 or 200 some microns. And then measured the apparent force on the microsphere in femtonewtons as a function of that bias voltage. And you can see that you can fit this data pretty well with a sum of a permanent dipole and an induced dipole moment. Really, in this case, the permanent dipole is completely dominating over the induced dipole moment at these low voltages. And you can measure dipole moments of something like 100 electron microns for these 5-micron spheres. When you turn off that bias, so you bias it to a nominal potential of 0 volts, this is what you see, where again the units are femtonewtons, but now we're in tenths of a femtonewton. We repeated this for 3 different microspheres, and you can see that there's a statistically significant residual response, so there's a force on the microsphere that depends on the distance. We can, however, fit this with the background model that we measure from purposefully misbiasing the cantilever, where we have the expected electrostatic force, and then on top of that add a possible screen scalar interaction. So in this case, we've used an inverse power law chameleon model just because they exist in the literature, and you can calculate it actually for this setup. That said, though, we think this is maybe a more model-independent test than just looking at this specific chameleon model, but the red line here is what you would get in that specific model. So you can put some upper limit on how large that sort of extra force from that specific model can be, and at least at the time of publication, this was competitive with the best results on these chameleons. And again, you know, chameleons are maybe one highly contrived model, but any sort of new scalar that you write down should be constrained by this sort of thing. I should say that this residual response is consistent with a kind of 30 millivolt bias on the cantilever, and you expect that level of misbias because we're setting the bias outside the chamber. There's contact potentials or different chemical potentials between the metals that are making all the connections. We didn't, in this measurement, try to tune that to zero. You could just tune this, but it would cancel out a force from a real screen scalar interaction, so we didn't try to do that here. Okay, so, yeah.
How big is gravity itself on this
scale? Much smaller, so 3 or 4 orders of magnitude smaller. So this is, you know, again, this is because this is the worst possible in terms of backgrounds attractor. So the real question is, with a better attractor geometry, can you do 3 or 4 orders of magnitude better? Okay, so let me just close in the last few minutes with testing Coulomb's law at short distances. Again, the motivation here is maybe you have some dark photon or light Miller charged particles that mediate a deviation from Coulomb's law in the same way that a new scalar would mediate a new force that couples to mass. This mediates a new force that couples to charge. If you look back at what the previous tests of Coulomb's law looked like, this is actually a picture from the beginning of Jackson, so probably you've seen this before. There's basically a spherical shell here where you're applying an oscillating voltage, and then you have a hermetic shielding electrode inside, and then you're measuring the electric potential inside a perfectly hermetic interior shield. That's the idea. Of course, there have to be some penetrations and things. But this is kind of the spacing between these electrodes are kind of 10 centimeter scale, and probably many of you are familiar with the dark photon plots where these Coulomb law tests show up, and these are really the experiments it's coming from. So the most recent of these experiments was in the kind of late 80s. If you were to push this to shorter distance, of course, with microspheres, you may be able to go down to micron scales, which would be substantial larger masses for this sort of dark photon model. So just one really quick slide on what this might look like with microspheres. So the idea is that you have an electrode, you apply a large DC field to polarize the sphere so that you can get a large dipole moment on the sphere. And then you have a fully hermetic shield around an electrode with a high AC bias. So you're oscillating a 10 kilovolt per millimeter field here on this electrode. And then, you know, if Coulomb's law holds exactly, this is fully screened by the equipotential surface, the grounded surface of the outer jacket on this sort of conductor. But if you had some sort of dark photon or something like this, you'd see some exponential leakage of the field outside this conductor. And I'd be happy to talk to people, experts here, about how to do this calculation very precisely, but with some very rough estimates of what our sensitivity might be, you get this kind of sensitivity to coupling on the vertical axis versus here, this is 1 over length scale, so this is the mass of the dark photon, but otherwise very similar to the inverse square law for gravity plot. Again, these Coulomb limits are from the previous tests. In principle, you could push to higher dark photon mass or shorter distances, as well as potentially even shorter couplings. The solar limits here are the kind of gray regions. So with our current sensitivity, it would be tough to do much better than those solar limits. But if you could really push this system to the ultimate limits, you might be able to push down below and in a range where actually there aren't too many other competing experiments that are very sensitive in this range. So.
Projectors is available for everyone, including ALPS and ADMX.
Yeah, so ALPS, you know, has some curve like this, ADMX.
So it's a projectors.
Projected, yeah. Yes, projected. And
the dark photon doesn't have to be dark matter, right?
Yeah, so that's the other nice thing about this. So the reason the kind of laboratory tests are maybe bolder color here is that all these are lab-produced dark photons.
The sun limit.
Yeah, the sun does not.
ADM radio and ADMX do.
ADMX is dark photon one is way below that, so I'm not sure what this ADMX one is.
I may have grabbed the old. So their current dark photon is well below this, or their projected?
Yeah, they have a current dark photon dark matter thing, which is way below that.
Yeah.
Maybe a different thing they're doing.
I'd appreciate it if you send me a reference for that. I could have missed the proper reference to put on here. So, you know, there's also this line in the Sensei paper last night that the solar limits should be thought about carefully. I don't know what that means. No. Okay. Okay. So, that's it. I mean, so these techniques are really, I think, just starting. So there may be applications we haven't thought of yet, but it seems pretty obvious to test Coulomb's law and Newton's law at short distance and use neutrality and matter tests. But we're obviously also interested in thinking more with people here about what else you could do with these kind of levitated masses. So, thank you.
So, maybe you mentioned this somewhere, but why is this, can you do this, can you use this kind of stuff to improve on at WASH?
Yeah, so the Edwash plot is this one. So this is Edwash. So what you can do is push to shorter distance. Yeah.
For the screened situation.
Well, this is the unscreened situation. So this is just, in this case, a new Yukawa force, or, you know, we just write this sort of deviation from gravity, but you could draw this plot for any sort of new potential. So if you just add any unscreened new force that's coupling to mass, then the sensitivity we might be able to get, it looks something like this. So you push down kind of to 10 micron scale, and if we really got here, I think we could push further if we optimized it a little different.
I thought lambda was the screening scale.
No, here lambda is the kind of inverse mass of the new scalar or something like that. It's a generic length scale that this Yukawa force would show up at. So this is not a screen sort of thing. This is if you add a new scalar with mass of 1 over lambda, what is, and some coupling that gives you strength alpha.
I guess
so screening, you know, for the kind of chameleon things, screening means that there's some mass or other dependence to what that lambda is. Yeah, so here this is a constant lambda, but if you added a screening mechanism, lambda might vary depending on how much matter's around.
Extremely far from my expertise, but there's these, I don't know how plausible fields, the theories of like spin-dependent gravity, non-Yukawa, like non-spherically symmetric, and you have these incredibly fast spinning things. Is there some way you can cash in on that?
I'd like to talk to people here about that. I mean, whether you can look for, you know, some sort of torque on a spinning object, or, you know, fundamental dissipation mechanism for a spinning object.
Just an object spinning this way is lighter than an object spinning this way.
Yeah, maybe.
Can you polarize these?
Well, we can change the spin direction if that's. Right. I mean.
Can you polarize the spin of the silica within the sphere?
Yeah, so we can use magnetic spheres. We're thinking about doing that. So they have to be optically transparent for a current system. And the temperatures also get quite high, so sometimes you have to worry about Curie temperatures. But there's no reason you can't. So, you know, there's actually a whole industry of making magnetic sensors that you can put back next to microfluidic capillaries. So we're thinking about making magnetic sensors anyway. And eventually we'll think about spin-dependent forces, but you could also, in principle, polarize spins inside these objects, yes.
So anytime I hear about precise measurements of forces acting on spheres, you think about cosmic relic neutrino measurements.
Yeah, right.
Now there, I guess, the size of the sphere you'd want is like millimeter scale.
Well, so actually, so there's this old paper from Peter Smith, which points out that the Broglie wavelength of those relic neutrinos is like 800 nanometers. So if you have a 100 nanometer sphere, you get a coherent enhancement of the, you know, get like A squared, where A is 10 to the 13 or something. So you probably want a kilogram of 100 nanometer objects.
So let's say someone gave you, I don't know, $100 million. Yeah. But the issue too is the force that you're looking at is like 10 to the minus 28 little g, right?
Yep.
So if someone
the acceleration you, due to that.
Yeah, the acceleration. Yeah, sorry, the acceleration.
Yeah.
If someone gave you $100 million,
you do better with the nanostructured thing because the rate of scatters goes up like 10 to the 26 or something, right? So it actually is substantially better, but you have to somehow get a kilogram of 100 nanometer objects that you're measuring at the standard quantum limit, and then you can do it. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe these are little microspheres floating in superfluid helium or bubbles in superfluid. You can think. But.
What did you say, a kilogram, to make it coherent over the whole kilogram?
You want it to be in 100 nanometer blobs so that the coherence stays, but then to get the rate up, you need a kilogram.
The rate from.
If you have some expected abundance of the cosmic neutrino background, in order to have any chance of seeing that above, you know,
it's just the scaling of the number of spheres there. You've maxed out with your individual sphere.
Yeah.
Then
you make more.
It's, yeah, n squared is the thing that's the 100k, and then n for the number of those objects that you need to go in. I don't know why I thought it was special.
It's not. It's just the if you know the abundance that and you put in all the factors, that's roughly what you get.
And you're just looking for scattering events off those neutrinos? You're looking for a sort of coherent force? Like, what does the signal look like?
No, there you're looking for an individual 100 nanometer grain to move. So you're actually seeing a scatter with an individual grain.
You can't see that. No, that doesn't work.
Well, but
it has to be multiple scatterings.
Sorry?
It has to be multiple scatterings.
Well, what do you mean it doesn't work? I mean, if you have a 100 nanometer sized object that you're measuring the position of at the standard quantum limit.
Because the momentum, so the neutrino scattering has got to transfer momentum, which is net, which is the order of the neutrino momentum.
Yeah.
And the position of each grain is localized to a size smaller than its size, which means that its momentum uncertainty was larger than the momentum you're transferring to it. So it doesn't change the state of the. It's like scattering a photon off a mirror or something.
But let's say this thing is moving coherently for some amount of time.
Yeah. Again,
you're saying you can't have cooled the object into a state where.
You need to have cooled it, yeah. So you need to have made its wave packet, the center yes. mass position, uncertain over a distance larger than its size, which you can do in these, like, double slit experiments, but in any normal setup just basically never happens as far as I'm aware.
Well, but that's what people are doing specifically with these. They're trying to make a massive object in the quantum ground state.
But again, the quantum ground state is not enough, right, in any reasonable material. It needs to be...
It's trapped, right? The sphere is trapped.
Yeah.
And so in that, you know, photon or whatever comes in to hit it, kinetics, you know, I guess I would say the Lamb-Dickey parameter is really small, I would think, for this.
Yeah, so the inelastic scattering will not be coherently enhanced in this way. So the excitation rate will not be.
If the extent of the trap is sufficiently much larger than the object that you're trying to keep coherent, then I think that, you know, you're not going to know that you've pushed it beyond the trap. But if the trap and the size of the object are unstable enough equilibrium, it seems like you would know.
Yeah, if your thing was delocalized over distances much larger than its size, then you could detect.
That's a very, very floppy trap. That's a trap that's like, because it's 10 microns wide ground state.
Yeah, your ground state needs to be that. It needs to be interactions don't localize it any more than that.
Sure. But, I mean, these are very floppy traps in that sense, right? I mean, you have a 100 nanometer object sitting in a few micron sized trap.
Oh yeah. So is your ground state this thing delocalized over more than the size of the thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Then you could detect that thing. That's true. Okay. Yeah.
So I mean, you know, those sort of experimental details I think are far from. You know, the question is how would you really levitate this, or you know, how would you get enough of these masses into reasonably low noise state that you could actually see these collisions. I mean, then you can think about these details about what the trapping potential looks like. But
why did you say 100 nanometers? So if I have like a 0.05 dB neutrino traveling at 10 minus 3 in actual units, isn't that more like 10 centimeters?
I think the size, I don't think of is like millimeters.
Yeah.
You know, a few millimeters. I guess here.
Yeah, actually, what's going on?
Velocity, yeah, so I'm not actually sure. Maybe they're different experiments, right? So normally, I mean, the torsion, the cosmic relative neutrino torsion experiment, you're coherent over a few millimeters, right? Because this is the effect where you're just looking for the motion of the solar system.
That's right,
in
yeah.
the cosmic relative neutrino background, that's the velocity scale.
Yeah.
And, I think the answer you get, once you put in factors of 2 and 4 pi's, is a couple of millimeters.
Yeah, I mean, well...
Maybe I'm wrong about the length scale. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, I haven't thought about this in detail, but there is this old paper from Peter Smith where I'm remembering 100 nanometer scale for the drop.
Taking 0.1 eV is, and eV is like 10 to my 6 meters, right, going from femtometer to GeV or something, and then I'm going to put in a V of 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah.
And so the Broglie wavelength is somewhere around centimeters.
Yeah, and then the coherence, the coherence length, there's some factors of 2. And
sure,
five,
yeah, there's factors of 2 and pi there. Right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The coherence volumes are like a few millimeter cubed, I think.
Yeah.
So can we just close the loop on it? Like, so what does this look like? If I took a bowling ball in this room and cooled it down to the ground state, do you look like it was, it's a heating rate that comes from scattering off these primordial, is that what it is? It's a, in a neutrino-less world, there'd be no heating, and in this world, there is this very low heating rate. I mean, I don't even yet see what our signal is, and if that's it. That's a brutal experiment, but okay. I mean,
well, they all are for this specific.
But that's even lower, because you're looking for a DC heating rate, which is set off by.
You get a modulation.
It's a force. Basically, you should think of there's a stationary cosmic relic neutrino background. The solar system is moving in that.
So it's a wind. It's a blowing on it. Yeah. It's a deep. It's a DC wind. It modulates that 1 year.
Yeah, there's.
And if you have directionality, it modulates by a day. If you can see the direction.
Okay, it's a one, whatever that is, a microhertz, whatever that is. Microhertz modulated.
If you have direction, though, you also see it trace out in the sky, which is, I think, actually pretty good, right? Even though it sounds like a hard frequency, because it's pointing coherently at the same direction, you're okay.
Anyway, but for this scale, also, I mean, Ben's emphasis, the scale, it's not nanometer type objects. I mean, it's. Okay, millimeter is a little bit bigger than...
Millimeter is probably impossible if I have the numbers wrong, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, nanometer is for KDP.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks,
well, let's thank David again for a great talk. All right, so...